Good morning. Just seeing that the mic works, and it does. Hiroshima. You know, it's such a big subject to even begin to talk about from a personal point of view. And I feel very humble to even think of taking this opportunity to talk about the poems and an aspect of my life in South Africa. And we know that President Obama recently visited Hiroshima, the first sitting American president to make this auspicious journey. Yet for all of us, Hiroshima is always there at the back of our minds, just as we live with the events of 9/11. Yet for me, as a young woman in my 30s, living in apartheid South Africa in the 1960s, it became a symbol of a personal and traumatic event in my life. Let me give you some background to the apartheid laws. With the rise of the apartheid government in the late 1950s, new and harsh laws were enforced that threatened the expression of any liberal actions and even any contact by whites with the suppressed black community. In fact, whites who helped blacks in any way were also threatened by these new laws, and I had friends who were arrested without a trial, and some of them were even held in prison indefinitely. My husband, a courageous man, worked with black actors, creating provocative plays where just ordinary men and women were able to give voice to their anguish at the injustice that prevailed in our country. His work was considered seditious by the apartheid authorities, even though it was theatre and not a political event. He first had his rehearsals in a building in New Brighton, and that was a sprawling black township outside the city of Port Elizabeth. But the police were aware of this, and soon he was prohibited from entering the township and stopped by the police when he tried to meet his black actors for a rehearsal, not a political meeting. And when he was forbidden to get to this venue, he did not give up, but invited the black actors to drive to our white area, a small coastal community where we had a simple cottage. Our black friends came and rehearsals continued, but many of our neighbors were outraged. Nobody had blacks visiting. It was unheard of and very shocking to people. And we were often ostracized by our neighbors. Then, one day when my husband and I were having lunch, a government official arrived and he said to my husband, "We've come here to confiscate your passport. You are no longer allowed to leave South Africa." And that was quite a shock. My husband was beginning to get a reputation in England, and now he was unable to travel. For me, who was very much involved in his work, the stresses and anxieties of all this caused me to slip into a breakdown. And it began rather strangely. It was on a day when I wandered into the garden. It seemed to me, when I looked out across the Indian Ocean, huge clouds had massed and there were plumes of fire. And in that moment of stress in my own life, I for a moment believed that an atomic bomb had exploded somewhere out there over the Indian Ocean. My difficulties with dealing with South Africa were reflected in the symbol of the mushroom cloud explosion in the sky that I believed had actually happened. And voices seemed to echo from that terrible event of the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima in August 1945. My husband, sensing my distress, hurried into the garden and said, "Look, it's just a winter storm. It's nothing to be worried about." And he took me back to the house. I believed him and recognized my moment of confusion. Yet somehow I was aware of the voices of the people who had died on that day in Hiroshima. I began to do my own research from material that was available and discovered the lives and stories of the people who endured the atomic fallout on Hiroshima. Their voices became poems that I wrote down with a feverish sense of purpose. But worse was still to come for us. A few months later, our house was searched by the security police. They came in the darkness, in the middle of the night, at 3 a.m. They hammered on the door, shouting they had a warrant to search our house. They woke us up, and we just stumbled out of bed, confused and fearful. There were 3 officers there, they plainclothes men, and they pushed past us and entered the house. I cried out with all the anxiety of a parent, please, our 6-year-old daughter is asleep in the bedroom. I had to think very quickly that if they took one of us away, or both of us, there was a big Ford car parked outside, that I had to keep my daughter safe, and I knew that this problem occurred, I would take her to a neighbor who was a friend, and that neighbor would get my daughter to her grandmother. In the house, one of the officers grabbed my purse and searched it, tossing out my lipstick, wallet, tissues, and address book. He threw it all down on the floor. Then he saw a yoga magazine with an OM sign on the cover. He grabbed it and demanded of me, what is this magazine? What is this on this cover? I balked and stuttered, it's just a yoga magazine. That's an OM sign. In the 60s, yoga wasn't around that much. And he dropped the magazine. And then I realized that they were such ignorant men, these security police, who were searching our house looking for any book or document that they thought might be connected with the Soviet Union or Communist China, the enemies of the apartheid government. Oh, we cowered as they began the systematic search of our house. They hammered on the walls as if they were looking for weapons, guns that were hidden there ready for an uprising. They took imprints of our typewriter as if they suspected that we might be disseminating seditious literature. As the search progressed, I became more anxious, for I knew that they would find them, my Hiroshima poems, and they did. A burly man with butcher's hands picked them up casually from a drawer in my desk. The handwritten, ink-stained Hiroshima poems where they lay unfinished. The officer waved them at me. I remember how he sneered and said, there are foreign words in these poems, maybe Chinese words. And what do you know about Red China? And he wanted some explanation from me. I recall my terror as the man once again flipped the poems as if they were a pack of cards. Terrified, I whispered they are just poems, Japanese words, nothing to do with China. He sneered, flipped the poems, and then dropped them on my desk. He left the poems and then continued the search, going through files of bills, correspondence, and finally the many books that lined our walls. I can only think that they were looking for some code that was somewhere hidden in our house. I stared at the Hiroshima poems, still piled up in a tidy stack, smudged by dirty hands, but left untouched. Yet I felt that I had been pillaged and banished to some other place. The hours passed, and finally they left us as the sun rose up in the sky. We stood silenced, 2 stricken people with no place to go. There was no escaping any of this. Yet I was relieved that my husband had been not taken away in that large Ford car that had brought the officers here. I would not have to visit the local prison, bringing him food or taking him laundry. He was still with me, and our lives would go on, and so would his work with the black actors, despite the stresses and fears that one day he might be arrested. I grasped the Hiroshima poems. I ran to my room and shut the door. I felt that I was a hermit with my task of completing the poems, still with the original copies that were stained, dirty, and mauled. My life had changed. I would struggle to live on through the apartheid years in South Africa. Finally, after some years, my husband's passport was returned, and we left the house overlooking the Indian Ocean, and my life moved on. I traveled to England and the United States, and the years of difficulty in South Africa were smoothed away. I could not look at the Hiroshima poems. It was as if they were like a stone that I'd thrown into the ocean and seen sunk into the depths forever. Surprisingly, decades later, when I stumbled upon the poems in a box after traveling, much had changed. I discovered that the poems were free and not obscured by my own traumatic experience of the raid on my house in South Africa. The Hiroshima poems now hinted at something very different. I sensed a warning about the dangers of our technology, about climate change, about our slow destruction of the planet, and our inability to control any of it. I was accepting of all of this, and at last ready for my pilgrimage to Hiroshima, the old city of ash and dust. I had waited 30 years for my visit to Hiroshima. I had finally arrived and brought the poems with me. I needed to sense the words of the poems in the people I met who had lived through the blast on that fatal day, and to understand how such a catastrophe fell upon this ancient land, Japan. I felt that these poems were like the forms of children that were now ready to be born. I had to allow the poems and the people who spoke them to enter the world. This is the work of poetry, and I share this with you today. I remember that from my hotel room, I looked out upon the new city of Hiroshima. Yet what I saw before me, the landmarks of history, the restaurants filled with people, the schools, the businesses, the life seemingly to have returned. I even noticed that birds flew in the sky and dogs barked in the street. Trains left on time for other destinations, even a once devastated city like Nagasaki. Yet all this bustle of a city was layered above what happened that day when Pikadon, the Japanese name for the atom bomb, raged here as the eternal fire of all endings. The river Ota became a burning tide while the buildings crumbled and people melted away. We will have a poem on Hiroshima.
Harp song for Hiroshima. Spiraling over a Japanese city, an American pilot relieved himself of the bomb. How do we free ourselves of them, radiation men? Dissolving in a second's flash, they flesh out in air, solidify in bone, blood, muscle. Understanding is to desire that involvement. Oh, my arm, oh, my heart, oh, my nervous system that brings me involvement with Hiroshima. Oh, radiation man, a wraith of Hiroshima, mend the torn muscle of the mind divided in grief. Our health we wear in disguise. We are as mutilated as they. Only our hearts bear the crater of Hiroshima, hidden under thick smiles of deepest mockery.
What can be said about those that survived? In the Peace Park, I encountered an old woman. In the Peace Park, I encountered an old woman, her scars of the radiation sickness hidden beneath a dark kimono. I recognized her as one of those, a hibakusha, a survivor of the Hiroshima blast. There was no escape for her from the trauma, the keloid scars, the radiation sickness that sapped her life. She would never leave the city of cinders, the old Hiroshima. Unlike the children in the Peace Park who crowded about the monument of remembrance, she would remain trapped in the past. For her, the images of Pikadon's roaring descent upon the city would remain forever. This was a woman's life. She had the vision of fire. The mushroom cloud was mirrored in her eyes. The new city of Hiroshima was built upon the rubble of the old. It was as if a new layer of skin had been grafted onto an old body. It was not only the people who suffered in Hiroshima that day. A scientist made a film of a fish taken from the Ota River, still alive but caught in the blast. The fish lived for 8 days, and in that time evolved a double head and 4 eyes. We have the poem, The Fish.
Fish, in a green dream you plunge the depths, confusion, understood in Hiroshima as crucifixion, torments your divine essence, process of a dying tide, impairs sea changes within you, opaque, evolving from the ghost of your form, boned as a tree Buddha built from love. This head a second hand, the sea a shrunken waste, a white ghost's trapping, shrouds Hiroshima's tapping, a retaliation, this your mutation.
This other Hiroshima, Mike again, I'm sorry. This other Hiroshima, a city of blackened earth and strewn with ash, remains. There the people have been cinders, the clothes burnt from their bodies, eye sockets propped open by the vision of hell. The lives of people are what remains when the skeins of flesh are unraveled and minds that were seared by the roaring images of death in the sky. They could not search for a pebble, a blasted flower, and only piles of ash and rubble. The ghosts of the victims still walk the streets, as if looking for an exodus gate that would lead them out of this place of devastation. There is no exit from this hell. What to do about such places? The Italian poet Dante would have understood all this, for he was the poet of the hells, taking pilgrims down to the dark pathways of crucifixion. And finally, there was the vision of heavenly redemption. It is not only Dante who is present in the old city of ash and dust. Another great mind viewed Hiroshima differently. He was Albert Einstein. He did not directly participate in the creation of the atom bomb, but he was instrumental in facilitating the bomb's development. We have a poem.
Einstein, shake your white mane, great lion man of science, till the equation rattles in your skull. Marbles, instead of worlds sent spinning under the light of a million suns, peak a dawn, issuing as your single thought, destruction.
Thank you. The journey to peak a dawn is different. The hell is there, but there is no heaven upon earth. The fear is still there, the belief that one terrible mistake and it might all happen again. The river Ota flowing red with fire and blood. Nothing is ever the same since Hiroshima. Here in the hotel of the new city of Hiroshima, I recall the Tibetan Buddhist master Kala Rinpoche in his monastery high up in the Himalayas when I visited him years ago. Kala Rinpoche's voice echoed in me too as he extolled the virtue of compassion for all sentient beings, whether in the human or animal realm, the hell realm of Dante's Inferno. In my life, I have come to believe that Hiroshima is another inferno of our time. I laid out the Hiroshima poems on a table in the hotel room. I sat quietly, and it seemed that the poems written so long ago echoed through me like the wind of the Himalayas that blew through Kala Rinpoche's monastery, a wind that was whiplashing in its cold and carried within it the insistent roar of the sound, awake, awake, to the events that are happening to you and your time on earth. A voice in the wind. I recall the poems. I look carefully at the names of the victims of the Hiroshima blast, like the story of an old woman and this who helped victims, and this is her story.
I pass people on fire, crying water. I go to a stream, dip in my rice bowl. It seems as if with my very own soul I carry for them water to pour down angry red throats. Fire, saber cuts are no wilder than these wounds that lick out red tongues, pain. I journey further into my soul to the face of a man, wild-eyed child, bitter twisted thornbush. He whispers, Christ. I give him rice, poor child. Thorns crack into a smile. He dies. I am a ferry boat carrying Hiroshima sick upon my back. So frail am I now. I journey the world to the center of all souls until I know, too, I am one. Black as they, sickness binds me to them. I slip away, cowered from the scene. Memories walk me slowly up the path of the hill.
These voices that had spoken to me from the past, the sailor who endured the blast while out at sea, the children at school with their teacher, the prostitutes from the Miyamani district, the doctor in the Hiroshima hospital, I know them all. I have lived with them for 30 years. These voices from the old Hiroshima, a city of ash and dust, have bewildered and shattered me. In writing the poems, I have attempted to understand their lives and suffering. I wanted to release the poems into the air that rushed into the room and then have them scattered over the new city of Hiroshima, so that the voices of the long-dead victims of the old Hiroshima, the city of ash and dust, could be heard. These voices have become a harp song for Hiroshima, ghosts of the past that have spoken to us today. Let us end with the voice of the Hibakusha, the woman who survived the blast and lived to tell her story.
They, the Hibakusha, live for every 100 that died that day in Hiroshima. They are the dead, who walk ahead as Christ walked, their religion the testimony to the God of the mushroom cloud, energy, the total atom. O you untouchable ones, Hibakushas, bring us the knowledge of it, we who with our vagaries insist on living with seascape, the sunset, all the amenities of escapism. Hibakusha, tell us the moment when eyes ran from sockets, flesh bubbled from the bone, people vanished in a flash. We who with luck walk in brown sandals as he on the lakeside of Galilee. Only we do it heedless, mesmeric with laughter. The Hibakusha spoke. I put out my hand to touch my brother, and he disappeared. I put out my hand to touch his dust, and our city fell apart. A city of cards, a city of atomic dust. Our Hiroshima, a city of eternal death. Only we who did not die, who eternally question. We, the Hibakusha, we who number 90,000, walk, repent, step ahead of you in our knowledge. There is need for us to touch our fingers to release the suffering, your hands to feel, It is to exist beyond the blast.
The archetypes of our lives remain. We live with Hiroshima and the Holocaust. Hiroshima has been rebuilt, a modern city. But the old city of ash and dust remains for us. We seek answers about acceptance and forgiveness. As for myself, with the wounds of the past and the history of another country, apartheid South Africa, I try to bring the strands of my own life together. I see the poems as being not only about Hiroshima, but also the struggle of each individual against oppression of whatever kind. The Hiroshima poems are a reflection of what happened on that fatal day. The people, the Hibakusha, are interwoven with that history. It is our story too, belonging to us all, a warning, a terrible reminder that this must never happen again.